Okay, we will reconvene the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation. Let's see, the first order of business is to introduce committee drafts. And I would, before I move those, I would remind the audience and people that the purpose of the introduction is just to get the bills, the drafts, into the process. It does not, a vote to do that by any of the members does not commit them to vote for the bills. It's not intended to do that. It's just to get the process started. So with that, the chair would move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. LC 31, dated 12-13-13. LC 52, dated January 10-14. And LC 242, dated January 14, 2014. With that, any discussion before we take a vote? There's none. Is there any objection to the introduction of the three bills? There is none. The motion is adopted. LCs 31, 52, and 242 are introduced as committee drafts. All righty. Now we'll move on. First up, Patrick?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First up, we're going to hear about one of those three LC drafts we just introduced, LC 31. It's a dealer-to-dealer title transfers, and I believe Jerry Hinton is here and ready to speak to us.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I would remind you, let's keep it short, shorter than we did in the other end, the other room, if you will.
Yes.
We will have a full discussion on this in a couple of weeks. So welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to address you today. My name is Jerry Hinn. I'm General Manager of Brazier's Portland Auto Auction. I am also, incidentally, a city councilor in the city of Gresham. But today, I am representing the automobile industry in Oregon, more specifically, the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, or the Used Car Dealers, the Oregon Dealers Association, or the New Car Dealers, the National Auto Auction Association, all of the wholesale auto auctions in the state of Oregon. And even though DMV cannot specifically endorse legislation that does not originate from them, Chris Ratliff, who is the DMV managing director, has provided very specific wording highlights to our document. And there is no ostensible opposition to this bond amendment, bill amendment. The statute that we're going to be talking about today is specifically the regarding the current statute that controls dealer surety bonds. The issue is that in 2001, legislation was adopted to provide an incentive for licensed automobile dealers to timely transfer clear titles to dealer-to-dealer transactions by requiring a purchasing dealer to pay the interest of another dealer from whom it received clear title within 15 days. If the dealer that provided the clear title did not receive payment, it was protected, at least to some extent, by the purchasing dealer's surety bond. In 2003, the legislature intended to create an exception from the 15-day payment rule for traditional flooring agreements with manufacturers and financial institutions. The legislative history of that exception clearly indicated that it was not intended to disrupt the customary industry practice between dealers where a purchasing dealer does not pay for the vehicle at the time of purchase, but only when the paper title changes hands and that the transferring dealer holds the paper title to secure payment. This practice often involves the purchasing dealer giving the transferring dealer a check for the purchase price, i.e. a float check, that the transferring dealer agrees not to deposit until the purchasing dealer sells a vehicle to a customer and requires the paper title. The way the 2003 exception was worded, however, had the unintended effect of accepting all dealer-to-dealer transactions under the customary practice from the 15-day payment rule. In 2011, the Court of Appeals, Oregon Court of Appeals, issued an opinion finding that an exception applies to float agreements, an agreement that essentially reflects the standard practice between dealers. As a result, a licensed dealer who provides clear title to another dealer does not have protection of a 15-day payment rule, no access to the purchasing dealer's bond, and thus no incentive to timely transfer title to the purchasing dealer. This ultimately affects timely transfer of title to downstream retail customers, and this primarily is why DMV is so interested in correcting this statute. The purpose of this proposed legislation is to clarify that the 2003 exception to the 15-day payment rule that was intended to only apply to a traditional flooring agreements with the manufacturers and financial institution does not apply to the transactions between licensed dealers. To clarify that the dealer delivering title is the dealer protected, to clarify the date on which the 15-day rule begins to run, and provide a means for transferring dealers to safeguard paper titles and cooperate with the Department of Transportation without losing the protection of the statute. I won't read the specific amendment that's in front of you. As background for this technical correction, a licensed dealer violates the Oregon Vehicle Code if it fails to pay all interest in a vehicle within 15 days of receiving clear title to that vehicle from another dealer. Unless the interest arises from an inventory financing security interest for which the dealer is a debtor, as applied to the customary industry practice, however, every transaction between dealers fits the dictionary definition of the exception because, one, the vehicle is inventory, two, delay in payment or holding of a float check is financing, and three, retention of the paper title is reservation of a security interest as a matter of law. Prior to the 2011 Court of Appeals case, a dealer who transferred clear title to another dealer but was not paid within 15 days had access to the purchasing dealer's bond. Without this protection, the dealer holding the paper title has no incentive to transfer clear title to the purchasing dealer until it receives full payment, which ultimately affects timely transfer of title to all retail customers. Again, the legislature can restore this protection, reinstate the incentive to timely transfer between dealers, clarify the dealer delivering the clear title document is the dealer to be protected, and clarify when the 15-day payment rule begins to run, and provide a means for a transferring dealer to safeguard the title documents from the loss and cooperate with the department without losing the protection of the bond, all of which will ultimately expedite transfer titles to downstream consumers. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Hinton. Are there any questions? We'll have a chance to discuss this in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
So thank you very much.
Most appreciated.
All righty, we now have two information pieces in the presentations. The first one is a presentation on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty. There's Representative Witt and Mr. Sullivan, and a cast of others, I guess. There he is. You're up. You want to bring anybody up with you?
They may follow me. I don't know. Mr. Chairman.
I'm on.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31. I am here this morning to share with you some of the findings that the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee arrived at based on hearings around free trade practices. That hearing occurred back in May of 13. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade agreement, as you may very well know, between the United States and 11 other countries. Our committee found that there are significant threats in that trade proposal to Oregon's ag and natural resource producers. Testimony indicated that in terms of our state's dairy industry, it would likely be decimated by the TPP, specifically due to a state-run dairy operation in New Zealand. Our meat producers would likely suffer a loss of markets. The one positive aspect was fruits and vegetables. It was sort of indeterminate whether or not there would be increases or decreases. It was likely that some would, either direction. And lastly, that our forest products industry, not unlike present trade situations and past trade agreements, would once again get hammered. The record on every trade agreement since NAFTA is dismal. We found that the U.S. Trade deficit typically rises with signatory countries each time we negotiate a new trade deal. That a very, very significant number of jobs are lost in the state of Oregon, about somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 80,000 jobs have been lost in Oregon due to trade agreements since NAFTA went into effect in 1994. That U.S. and Oregon companies that operate within the law on a high skills, high wage approach are put at serious disadvantages to foreign countries that don't operate at high levels of safety, environmental, and worker protections, and that in many instances, as a result of non-competitiveness, it puts our domestic employers out of business. And that in many instances, the very equipment in our state and U.S. Plants and facilities is actually shipped over to the countries that have rendered our domestic producers uncompetitive. There is typically a loss of U.S. sovereignty, and that consumers lose a significant knowledge base. Our committee also found that fair trade, as opposed to free trade agreements, would establish minimum standards and practices relating to workers, the environment, the public's health and safety, child laborers, consumers, and national sovereignty. It was significant that these trade negotiations are recognized as being done completely behind closed doors, if you will. There is a complete and utter lack of transparency, and that our trade negotiators, as well as the other 11 nations, have gone to extreme lengths to keep the public out of the process and uninformed. It appears one conclusion that could possibly be drawn is that the results of these trade agreements, which I have already mentioned, are so bad and so negative that they cannot withstand public scrutiny and debate. Senator Merkley, in a letter to our committee, suggested using our nation's anti-dumping laws as a model for overcoming these substandard free trade practices, whereby violations would result in a premium roughly equal to the assumed cost of compliance with the standards already mentioned. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to these other panel members who have actual specifics that they would like to discuss with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Who wants to go next? Mr. Sullivan?
Good morning, Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Starr. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the Oregon political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, commonly known as AWPPW. Along with the rest of the panel, I will try to bring attention to the NAFTA-style trade agreement titled the Trans-Pacific Pact. Like NAFTA, there is an attempt to fast-track the TPP, which would be an up-and-down vote. But I'm going to focus on past history of trade gone badly from some of my own experience. My point is to try and make everyone understand that before NAFTA, NAFTA-style fast trade track trade agreements, there was already a problem of unfair trade. I got out of the Navy in 1971. I returned to the steel mill I was working in and went back to my apprenticeship. I needed the work, like every young veteran, I think. It took me 7 years to complete a four-year apprenticeship because in that 7 years I worked 32-hour work weeks if I wasn't laid off 3 months, 9 months, and 6 months. I got into debt, and I had a young child and a wife, and it took my wife and I years to get out of that debt because of all this. But then it got me here to Oregon, so it wasn't all bad. Why were there so many layoffs in the steel industry? As Representative Witt pointed out, it was dumping. Dumping occurs when a company or a country sends a product overseas cheaper than they can manufacture it for. At that time, the steel workers in the 1970s had 526,000 union members. Today, their number is 150,000. You have to remember, steel industry is like the canary in the coal mine. It's usually the first victim. But the steel division of the steel workers now is not number one, which it was then in the 70s. It's number three. Paper is the number one division, followed by rubber. NAFTA was a treaty, and as far as I'm concerned, it still is a treaty, along with the TPP. There are four types of treaties: war, peace, trade, and commerce. When NAFTA came, the steel workers and a group named Made in America sued because NAFTA, being a treaty, needed 66 and two-thirds of the Senate to approve. They had to be present to approve it, which didn't happen. The suit worked its way through the courts, and in the wisdom of our Supreme Court, they announced this was not a treaty. This was a presidential agreement, which skirted the authority of the Senate to ratify treaties. Then comes the World Trade Organization, the next big one, which I might add circumvents laws that you and the Senate enact and the governor signs. The WTO can go so far down as the county government and circumvent it. Begs the question that why do we have representative government if it means that a tribunal of three can meet secret anywhere in the United States and do away with what our laws are? The TPP did horrible things, like there were TEDs, turtle extrusion devices, that the shrimpers in the United States, the Gulf states, put in. This allowed turtles to escape out of the shrimp nets. The countries of Southeast Asia sued because we were discriminated against their ability to make a profit, and they won. Another really gut-wrenching case I heard up in Seattle during the Battle of Seattle was an independent banana grower. If you're like me, I figured bananas all grew in jungles. Not the case. They grow on plots of land. And this woman explained how a lot of them are single mothers. And Chiquita Banana sued these independent growers because they were discriminated against Chiquita Banana's ability to make a profit. I'm going to close now. The panel will give you more information on the TPP and why it shouldn't be fast-tracked, why there should be a full debate. We have a lot of budget problems in Oregon, as you are well aware of, and we need to pay attention to them. But the truth of the matter is that the Oregon tax base is being shipped away overseas. We can't afford to give away our industrial jobs and the solid tax base it provides. We need a government, and we want a government. We need the tax base to support it. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions if there are any.
Senator?
Yeah, I have to go to another meeting, but I just want to put out a comment, and that is free trade is a great concept. However, the devil is in the details, and there really truly is no such thing as free trade when you get into the details. And so I think you have a very valid point, especially people in rural states. We tend to not do well in these free trade agreements. It's the manufacturing segments in the manufacturing states that do very, very well. So I wish you well. It's a federal problem. I don't know what you want from us at the state level, but I think you have a valid point.
Thank you, Senator. Who's next?
Good morning, Chair Beyer and committee members. For the record, my name is Greg Pallison. I'm the Vice President of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and we're affiliated with the Carpenters Union. I want to talk a little bit about the impact of what the past trade agreements have had directly on forestry-related jobs, pulp and paper industry. And the TPP is very similar to past trade agreement, so there's not going to be a lot of change, we don't believe. Oregon, along with most states, continue to see businesses shuttered as a direct result of our failed trade economic and trade policy, and Oregon's pulp and paper industry and forestry jobs have certainly felt the same negative impact. In the last 15 years, all of the Oregon pulp and paper manufacturing plants that have had either layoffs or plant closures were all approved for U.S. Department of Labor TAA benefits, the Trade Adjustment Assistance benefits. And the same is true for every state in which we represent members, except in California. There was one location that was not certified. In fact, California no longer has any pulp mills, and the trees and chips and things that are, you know, there are being exported mostly to China. In 2011, I think most of you know, Blue Heron Paper Mill in Oregon City closed its doors, and good-paying family wage jobs were permanently eliminated, and what was once the city's largest tax revenue is gone forever. And the pulp mill was a major customer for numerous small businesses, and research shows that for each mill job lost, there's at least four local community jobs lost. The mill had been a cornerstone for the city for over a century, and at one time employing over 500 jobs. The mill's business plan had changed from to produce some of the world's greenest and finest 100% recycled waste paper products. And to do so, it relied heavily on the recovered waste collected from the recycling throughout Oregon and Pacific Northwest. And Blue Heron, when it closed, actually had one full year of backlog orders. And like most all the mills that did not survive, the mill equipment has been dismantled, shipped overseas, and will be being reassembled, brought back online, producing the same products that we made here. And again, they filed bankruptcy. They could not survive. U.S. mills continue to have a difficult time competing for our own recovered waste paper. And the number of mills right now, we have fewer mills than ever, and they still are having a hard time getting chip and log supplies. Log exports are at record high levels, along with unemployment levels, especially in the rural areas. In 2009, Boise in St. Helens closed the pulp mill and the paper machine. Just this week, SB Newsprint in Newburg has announced they're closing one of the paper machines, and it's possible that machine will not restart. Again, keep in mind all of these facilities have previously been approved for TAA benefits, which means unfair foreign competition is the single biggest reason for the layoffs or closures. You don't get approved for TAA benefits without the investigation by the Department of Labor. As a direct result of these unfair trade agreements, we've seen our jobs move from in the forestry products to Canada, then to South America, then to Asia. And it's followed the trade agreements as they were passed. In 2001, China was allowed into the World Trade Organization, and not too long after that, exports of logs began to climb, along with finished products of our finished products going to them plummeted. China now produces more paper products than anybody in the world. Recovered waste paper is now the U.S.'s largest paper export, which is hard to believe. 70% of our U.S. recovered waste paper is exported. I think most Oregonians think that, you know, when they recover, put things in the recovered waste, it's helping the environment. And actually what we're doing is we're making the environment worse, because it goes where there's dirty power plants and things producing it. So, as a reference, I suggest you look at an article, July 21st, 2008, that was in the Oregonian that said China's mercury flushes into Oregon rivers. The Chinese industry can continue to pay more than anyone else because for the recovered waste paper and logs and things, because their industry is heavily subsidized, which is supposed to be illegal under the trade agreements, and in part because of their substandard labor costs along with weak labor environmental standards. China, believe it or not, is now worried about competition from India and other nations that have the fiber resources to manufacture the paper, and they have cheaper labor yet. Also, for all the plant locations that are still operating in Oregon, throughout the years, every contract negotiated, this is for the ones that don't close, every contract, labor negotiations, is concessionary. People are taking pay cuts or benefit cuts in order to try to compete. For a number of years, our nation has had a staggering trade deficit, and really the trade deficit is greatly responsible for our other deficits, the national deficit, our state and county deficits. We no longer have the tax base required for our infrastructure, for schools, or other basic services. Now, a number of politicians, unfortunately, believe the solutions to our deficits are for working families to take pay cuts, pay more for health insurance, reduce or eliminate pensions, to deregulate safety, environmental, labor laws, and deregulate banking, to have unfettered trade agreements, all at the same time while giving billions of dollars in tax breaks to businesses. In 2009 and 2010 alone, International Paper was granted a total for those 2 years of $3 billion in tax breaks from the federal government, all at the same time, claiming they'd keep the U.S. industry afloat. All at the same time, while they closed mills in the U.S., they closed the Albany mill, which was a profitable mill, and they purchased 15 mills in China. They did an expansion in Russia and India. They get this money handed to them, no strings attached. And, you know, the AWPPW, we oppose the fast track. And our membership opposed fast-track authority. We opposed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We do support trade and international trade, and we support U.S. Senate Bill back in Congress, S-3347, the 21st Century Trade and Market Access. And we support Senator Merkley's Bill S-1801, which is Level the Playing Field for Global Trade Act. You know, we need jobs, good jobs here. So in closing, you know, I find it interesting that if someone's supports protecting our country militarily, many others will consider that person a great patriot. However, if someone wants to support our country and jobs through trade regulations and economic actions, that person will generally be ridiculed, called old school, out of date, and even a terrible word, protectionist. Our great nation will most likely fall economically long before we fall militarily. And I just, again, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. And I did submit it, you know, a couple things for you to look at. You can see closures and the startups worldwide. And then the other list that I gave you, it's not just Oregon. I mean, this is obviously impacting all the nation. And this list, which is quite extensive, are mill, pulp mill, paper mill, and lumber and sawmill closures from 1990 through 2012.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to testify about the Trans-Pacific Partnership today. My name is Elizabeth Swagger. I'm with Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. We're a statewide coalition of labor, environmental, and human rights organizations working to promote a just and sustainable international trade policy that allows Oregon producers to compete on a level playing field. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is of deep concern to our members, and we very much appreciate this committee's attention to it, as it has potential to greatly affect the economy, the environment, consumer safety, and public policy-making space in our state and beyond. Starting with the basics, the TPP is a trade and investment pact under negotiation between the United States and 11 other countries in the Pacific Rim. They include Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, Vietnam, and Japan. Just amongst those 12 countries, the TPP is poised to set the rules of international trade and investment that covers approximately 40% of the total global economy. But the TPP is explicitly being negotiated as what's called a docking agreement, meaning that other countries can join on over time. In fact, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative has said that it's their intention for the TPP to eventually cover half of the countries in the world. One of the loudest and most consistent civil society complaints about the Trans-Pacific Partnership to date is something that Representative Witt has touched on. Despite 4 years of negotiations, the U.S. Trade Representative still refuses to tell the American public what's being proposed in our names. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative has barred the public and limited congressional review, and instead has been consulting on actual language for the Trans-Pacific Partnership with a select group of 600 cleared advisors, the vast majority of which represent transnational corporations such as Walmart, Cargill, and Chevron. This is a rollback in transparency for most trade of the past trade negotiations, and it's something that most members of Oregon's congressional delegation have spoken out against. The ability to influence the TPP during its formative stages is really critical, because unlike trade agreements of 30 or 40 years ago, which dealt strictly with issues of tariffs and quotas, pacts like the TPP set binding obligations that delve deeply into public policy areas traditionally in the hands of Congress and of state legislatures. What may be of specific concern to this committee is the TPP's ability to weaken efforts to support local industries and the growth of local economy. Areas of concern to Oregon's economy with the TPP include, first, low-cost labor. TPP countries like Vietnam are already being marked as low-cost alternatives to China for companies that are deciding where to locate employment. This could impact industries such as manufacturing or computer programming, and those are two areas of significant importance to Oregon's economy. Vietnam's average minimum wage is just a third of China's, so it's very, very difficult for Oregon producers to compete on a level playing field. Another area that would be impacted is the cost of natural gas. So natural gas prices in Asia right now are multiple times higher than the United States. And as such, the cost to produce and locating in energy-intensive industries is much lower here. However, the TPP would facilitate the export of natural gas and other fossil fuels, lowering the cost for employers abroad while raising them here at home. Another area of concern is government procurement. The TPP would shrink markets for Oregon producers by restricting buy local or buy local purchasing programs for schools, prisons, and other public institutions. I want to close by saying that the TPP boosters talk a lot about its potential to increase exports. They rarely, if ever, talk about the TPP's impact on offshoring, increased energy costs for manufacturers, public procurement, or any of that, nor do we hear about the negative impact of imports on local businesses. The Korea Free Trade Agreement was actually the last of such trade agreements promoted as an economy booster and a big job creator for the United States. Just after the first year, we saw not only is our overall trade deficit with South Korea up by a whopping 37%, but U.S. exports were actually down by 10%. I conclude with that just to say that sometimes we hear promises about how good trade proposals are going to be for exports from companies that actually want to move production overseas. It's very difficult for Oregon producers who don't benefit from taxpayer subsidies to compete on cost with developing countries, especially when transnational corporations decide to go in and set up large-scale export operations there under the protection of free trade agreements like the TPP. Lastly, I just want to call to your attention a bill that was introduced last week that would severely limit Congress's constitutional authority on trade policies, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. H.R. 3830, or the Bipartisan Congressional Trade Priorities Act, would revive the outdated fast-track process that forbids amendments to limits congressional power on trade to an up or down vote. On a free trade agreement as significant as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we need Congress to exert more influence on trade, not less. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Bill?
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Committee for the Record, Bill Fluting, Carpenters Industrial Council. Thank you for having this hearing today. I'll be quite blunt. The industrial manufacturing force in this country has been screaming for 30 years where our jobs are going. And if you noticed just a year ago on the national news, it made the news week after week, where is our American jobs? It just now brought the attention national. You've probably seen the example. They went to a home, and they stripped everything out of that house that was not made in America. What they had left was four bare walls.
And if they had started taking the lumber out, there wouldn't have been nothing left standing. That's the shape we're in today. We can't get a fair shake out of the International Trade Commission. And I'll give you some examples. We fought with Canada for years on lumber imports out of Canada. Now, granted, there's more detail about mills going down in this Northwest. If we had a national forest plan, we'd be a lot better off. But at the same time, in 2009, almost 2 billion board feet of finished lumber came in from Canada to the state of Washington and Oregon. There's something wrong with that equation. We fought this in the international court for years and years. There was a multi-million dollar, I'll call it a slush fund, that Canada had to pay for importing their lumber. And it takes a long time to work our way through this international court. And what happened one morning, I picked up the paper, and there it was. We won. I didn't read the second paragraph. When I got on the phone and started talking to some folks who had worked on this, they said, Bill, read the second paragraph. What they did, they split the United States in half. They agreed that the East Coast side was impacted by Canada. The West side, no. Can't explain that. Can't appeal it, but that's what happened. The United States had to return the tens of millions of dollars back to Canada that they had collected through this tariff while this war was going on. Just recently, we got a decision out of the International Trade Commission. It takes four steps before a final decision can be reached. China has been flooding the United States with their plywood. China can get that plywood in here at half what our producers can make it. One half. We won all three lower divisions, and we thought we had it made. Come the final vote, we lost 5-0. I got on the phone and I asked some of the people that I worked with. I says, can you find out where these people lived that voted? They had to be Chinese citizens. How we lost that, I have no idea, but we did. And that's going to impact this country. Let me give you a close example. I went to school in Dallas, spent most of my life there, 20 miles west of here. It had a Caterpillar plant. It had a thriving sawmill plywood. You could count on 600 high-paying jobs. They're all gone. 2 years after NAFTA came in, Caterpillar pulled up and moved to Mexico. They lasted 3 years down there. And when I asked why and how they couldn't make it down there, their average turnover down there in their workforce was 1 month. Just enough in their check that they could head north. And guess where they headed? If I guarantee you, if Dallas was not a bedroom society of Salem, every day 12,000 cars leave Dallas and head towards Salem. If we were 70, 80 miles further away, two-thirds of that town would have moved. Right now in that town, every block you drive by on Main Street and every side street, big windows, store windows that once thrived are covered with paper. They're closed. We can't afford another trade agreement to go bad, not only for Oregon, but for this nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Anybody else? That's it. Unfortunately, I think you're speaking to a panel that is in support of you, but we don't have a vote. So those guys back 3,000 miles from here who get a vote on that.
That's right.
Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, and that's obviously the case, and regrettably so. But I do think that there are some things that we can begin to do here at our state legislature. We can begin demanding that trade negotiations done supposedly in our behalf be conducted in an open fashion, that transcripts be kept of the negotiations, that the public be made aware of all of the different industries and chapters that are being negotiated in trade law, so that they can comment on that, so that we can in a public forum, in a public fashion, begin the debate of what would benefit not only the citizens of Oregon but our entire nation, and what's the downside? Who are the winners? Who are the losers? And continually we have been losers as a result of these trade deals. So that's number one. Number two, I think we also as a state legislature need to begin to demand the ability for ourselves to enact standards and practices, as I mentioned in my testimony, relating to workers, to the environment, to consumer protections, to child labor, to national sovereignty. These are critical components, not only in our ability to be able to negotiate them in the trade agreement itself, but for us as a sovereign nation to be able to uphold those principles and self-determination. Is it in our own nation's interest to be able to have, Mike's left, but for our nation to be able to require that fishermen's nets be able to allow the escapement of turtles, or that if we choose to provide protections for child labor, or certain protections for consumers, or certain protections for our environment, that these cannot subsequently be ruled unfair trade restraints in an international trade court that is not conducted on American soil and is not conducted by American judges, but is in fact imposed upon our nation. That is completely wrong. That is a complete and utter destruction of the concept of national sovereignty, Mr. Chairman, and we can begin that effort here in Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any parting shots? Oh, Mike.
Just want, Senator, if you and the committee would like to write a letter to Representative Bonannici and Blumenauer to stay fast on the idea of no to a fast-track TPP, that would be great.
Welcome to see a draft.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I would welcome this a draft. Okay. Well, welcome, Senator.
I've been waiting for a phone call.
Oh.
I believe your staff fell down on that, Mr. Chair. We got too lost in the transition between rooms.
Okay.
You're going to phone him in for that presentation.
No, okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That's my bad.
That's okay.
Right.
Well, let's go on to our next item.
Last item.
Gentlemen, thank you for waiting.
Oh, sure.
These last sessions, just before we get into a real session, tend to fill up fast, so I appreciate your patience.
Thanks for having us. My name is Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist and director of the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined today by Carl Batten from Echo Northwest. The work that Carl's going to present to you today arose out of the Highway Cost Allocation Study effort. The Highway Cost Allocation Study is a constitutional requirement we do every biennium, which takes a look at the highway expenditures that were allocated by the legislature and tries to determine what a fair split of those costs between the different users of the road are. So we look at different classes of vehicles, the heavy trucks and the light vehicles, and try to determine what kind of road wear they put on the facilities that are being have been allocated by the legislature and split it out. In the 2009-11 biennium, the legislature asked us to expand on this study and start to consider other costs in addition to road wear. My role in this study is as chair of the study review team, which is made up of stakeholders and academic experts in transportation policy and engineering and the like. The study review team led the work on the that Echo Northwest did as well on the work with efficient fees, this additional study that was put in place in 09 and 11. The idea being that road wear isn't the only cost that users impose on the system. We also, when we drive, we create environmental damage, and we also create congestion and delays for everyone in the economy. So the efficient fee study was a first step in accounting for these other costs in addition to road damage. And it's a very, you know, appealing argument for economists. We know that the private markets, if left on their own, folks will drive too much. When people make individual decisions on the cost benefit of driving, those don't line up with societal costs and benefits, insofar as when I decide whether or not to drive to work, I don't really factor in the small impact I'm going to have on overall Oregon's pollution or overall Oregon's congestion. But added up across the entire society, these are significant. So economists who love prices say, well, if you could price this right and make drivers internalize the costs that they're imposing on everyone else in the state, well, then we can arrive at an efficient level of transportation. So this is really an attractive idea to economists. It's also attractive insofar as we know in our study that the gas tax is broken, and that with fewer vehicle miles traveled per job and better energy efficiency and fuel efficiency of our vehicle fleet, gas taxes are struggling both in the their ability to be effective in their over time, their ability to draw revenue, as well as their equity across different vehicles and different classes within both light and the heavy vehicles. So it's attractive to us, but similar to Senator Girard's comment on the free trade section before us, as nice as this is in theory, the devil is really in the details. So that's what this paper starts to get at. As part of last biennium's highway cost allocation study, we started to work on this work in terms of the pathway to efficient fees, in terms of what steps would be required in Oregon to get there, and we look at the experience in other jurisdictions. You know, what's the state of the art in terms of trying to levy fees on these different various costs that users impose on the road. And so that's what Dr. Batten is going to detail for you. Next steps in the current biennium, the RFP for the new highway cost allocation study just hit the street, and the study review team has requested that we continue this work but get down to more of a implementation details. In the current biennium studies, we're going to talk about some of the technology options and needs, the data requirements of putting together these fees, what we would have to do in terms of protecting privacy of individuals. So what are we going to need? We're going to need toll booths or transponders or the like, you know, and so we're going to get down some of those technical implementation details in some studies that we're going to be conducting this biennium. So with that, I'll pass it over to Dr. Batten, who will describe the pathway paper.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carl Batten, employed by Echo Northwest in Portland, Oregon. As Mark pointed out, the concept of efficient free road pricing is very appealing to economists, and the reason for that isn't just that vehicles will be tolled or will pay fees as they drive, but what makes the efficient fee different is the amount of the fee that each vehicle pays each time it drives is the right amount. The vehicle will be charged the cost it imposes for that trip, including the wear and tear that it imposes on the roads and bridges, the cost of delay that it imposes on other users of a congested road if it's operating on a congested road, the cost of its emissions impose on others, and its share of the administrative costs that are incurred by the agencies involved.
Carl, this differs in terms of the current state of the cost responsibility study only covers the first point.
The current study focuses on the first point. The second one is included indirectly through the cost of capital improvements that are made to address congestion. But it is indirect in the current method. And the cost that a vehicle imposes as it operates varies with the size and weight of the vehicle, the physical characteristics of the road or bridge it's on, the speed flow conditions of that road relative to the free flow conditions, that's a measure of how congested it is, and the emissions produced by the vehicle. Now, Oregon is different from other states in that heavy vehicles in Oregon do pay fees that vary with the size, with the weight of the vehicle. So those are actually, that portion of Oregon's system is actually very close to an efficient fee. The way you could make it a little bit more efficient would be to give the heavy vehicles a discount, for example, if they were operating on a road that was built to handle heavy vehicles, like an interstate freeway or a highway that was built to those standards. So the advantages of efficient fee road pricing are that each vehicle, as well as every class of vehicles, pays the right amount. The fees are automatically fair and equitable, and the revenues can be attributed to specific facilities where they, if you look at where the vehicles are running up the charges, you can see where the system is telling you that money should be spent on maintenance or on capital improvements. And road users would have an incentive to make the optimal use of the road system, as Mark pointed out. They'll choose to drive when it's best for themselves and for everyone else. And they will not have an incentive to overuse facilities, which is what you get with it, where everyone's paying the same price. And then agencies will have the revenue and the information that are necessary to build and maintain the optimal system. Because the fees automatically produce the right amount of revenue, the revenue that accumulates in excess of what's required for maintenance is the right amount to spend on capital improvements to address the congestion or to replace wearing out items. So the relationship between the efficient fees and highway cost allocation, if efficient fees were actually in place, there would be no need for highway cost allocation studies because the system would automatically be fair and equitable. One way to go about conducting a highway cost allocation study where we try to determine if the current law fees are equitable is to calculate what share of revenues each vehicle class would produce under an efficient fee system and compare that to the share they produce under current law. The advantage of doing it this way is that it allows the allocation of costs rather than of expenditures. And as we go through the different highway cost allocation studies and the different biennia, we discover that sometimes there's a lot more expenditure on bridges than another biennia. And the allocation of costs on a bridge is different than it is when you're spending on a road. And that affects the results of the study, even though in the long term, the heavy bridge spending year and the year when you don't spend very much at all on bridges, neither one of those is really right in the long run. And the efficient fee method would overcome that problem. Oregon first looked at this method in the 2001 study, and again did it in much more detail in the 2011 study. The results of the 2011 study show that a congestion charge in Oregon under the conditions that prevailed in 2009, which was a recession year, congestion charge would produce $209.5 million per year, and light vehicles would pay 96% of that. Wear and tear charges would produce $616.3 million of annual revenue, and light vehicles would pay 37% of that. Emissions charges would produce almost $500 million of revenue, and light vehicles would pay 67%. And then to pick up the remaining amounts necessary to cover the administrative costs, you could have a VMT charge, and if you did have a VMT charge, light vehicles would pay 93% of that because they account for 93% of VMT in Oregon. So overall, light and heavy vehicle classes would pay about the same as now, but individual vehicles might pay very different amounts. To clarify what we mean by efficient fee pricing, I'll talk a little bit about what it isn't. There's a variety of methods for imposing road pricing. The simplest of those are a static mileage charge, a simple per mile VMT tax, or an area pricing or parking charge, and those are when you pay to cross a line, sometimes called cordon pricing, to go, and it's typically on the core of an urban area like central London has one. You can achieve a similar effect with parking charges where you make people pay to spend the day inside the central core of a city and discourage them from bringing in as many vehicles in by having a high parking charge. Getting a little less simple, you can have managed lanes like the high occupancy toll lanes that are and there's a lot of them in California and around the country. And these are where you take a high-occupancy vehicle lane and allow single-occupant vehicles to buy their way in if that lane is underutilized. That's the most common form of managed lanes in this country because it's one that's easy to set up under federal regulations. And so the managed lane system may use efficient pricing on part of a facility. They don't have to. There are a few managed lane facilities around the country that just have a price schedule that some committee came up with, and that's how they price them, regardless of what the traffic is at the time. There's also partial network pricing. I don't believe there's any of these actually in effect other than tollways in the country, but one way to go about getting a good part of the benefits that that ubiquitous pricing would bring is to apply it to the arterial system, the freeways and expressways of an urban area. The 2009 legislature asked ODOT to investigate congestion pricing in Oregon and to come up with three pilot projects. That was in House Bill 2001. ODOT and its partners designed pilots. One was to toll Cornelius Pass Road between US 30 and US 26. One was to toll three on-ramps to Highway 217. And one was to implement parking charges in Central Oregon, or Central Portland, sorry. Each of these three pilot ideas was evaluated, and it was determined that none would really be able to achieve their goals, and none of them was actually implemented. But as a result of this, we did learn some valuable lessons. It's very difficult to achieve the benefits of efficient fee pricing with an incremental approach, especially when diversion is easy. And the same issue has come up looking at the CRC, where if you try to toll just one of two parallel routes, it doesn't work very well.
Nope. So you're suggesting we just put a toll over every bridge across the Columbia River?
That would be what efficient pricing would imply. That toll may be low on some bridges, especially at certain times of night. Maybe very low, but
or just toll
yes.
One. Don't do anything. Problem solved. Just in the short term, according to yesterday.
And we as the other side of that, we learned that a more systematic and strategic approach will be required to actually get a pilot study on the ground and working. But the work instigated by the 2009 legislature did leave us with a research and evaluation framework that will have value in the future. A different pilot project was conducted by the Puget Sound Regional Council in the Seattle area. In that study, which was funded by the federal government, they got 275 households in the Seattle area to participate for 2 years with these what they called onboard units, these devices in their cars that that implemented pricing, you know, in something very close to an efficient fee system. There was a six-month pre-study where the people drove around with these devices in their cars, and it figured out how much they would have paid if they had been paying tolls during that time. Now, the people weren't paying tolls, and they didn't really know what the tolls would have been. So this is a good, this is a baseline amount. If their behavior didn't change, they would pay this this amount. And then they were given an endowment of $75 more than that amount in their account. And this was real money. And then they drove around for a year with these devices activated to tell them what the prices were as they drove around and allow them to make decisions about choosing different routes or in the longer run making their trips at different time or taking transit or whatever. It turned out that the, and then there's a six-month post-experiment that that gained some additional information, but at the end of the year, almost everyone had more than $75 left in their account, and they got checks for that amount. The experiment revealed that people willingly made adjustments in travel, and that if everyone in the Seattle area made similar adjustments, it would have a huge impact on the performance of the transportation system, the existing system in Seattle, which if you've been there during rush hour, you know that it doesn't perform all that well today. So as a result of all this, the Highway Cost Allocation Study Review Team has been looking at what it would take to get toward efficient pricing in Oregon. The technology exists, and it's getting better every year. The technology that was used in the Traffic Choices Study is now 10 years old. That those devices had a GPS unit inside them, so the device knew where it was on the network. It had a price schedule inside it that was updated regularly through the cell phone network. It kept track of how much money was in the account, and it decremented it as you drove around, and then it also reported back the amount remaining in your account through the cell phone network. A device like this can hold inside it the information about where you drove, but the government doesn't need to know that information. Your privacy can be protected, and if you need to have an audit for some reason, a third-party auditor can evaluate the information inside the unit without telling the government where you went. They can tell the government that either, yes, you paid the right amount, or no, you didn't. So efficient pricing can produce benefits in excess of cost where less than efficient pricing can't. And one of the main points I'd like to make here to you today is that that investment in a less than efficient implementation could postpone getting to a good efficient implementation. That from our experience, baby steps aren't necessarily the best way to get there.
So doing something like that, it would require some form of billing system?
It would require some form of accounting system. The system could be entirely prepaid. It could be partly prepaid and partly post-billed, or it could be billed after the fact. Experience with tolling in other parts of the country indicates that prepaid accounts are more efficient and result in lower administrative costs and higher collections.
We did the BMT study. I think maybe everybody on the committee participated. Mm-hmm. But that was a monthly thing, as I recall.
Well, yeah, that's probably how it would work, just depending on which provider you ultimately used, determine how you, whether you put money in the account and subtract it out, or they just billed you.
I suppose your notion of you could have, we're in a permitting system, we have to buy our annual registration fees, you could have, you pay a certain amount, and then like your Seattle model, you decrement against that, or I guess credit forward mm-hmm. the other way.
And some of the tolling systems, including the one that's being proposed for the CRC, would allow you to either prepay into your account by writing a check or authorizing an ACH transfer or something, or by providing a credit card number, and then your credit card gets charged periodically.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thanks. In the Seattle experiment, were effects looked at based on income demographics? I mean, did less wealthy people, did the poor really respond, and were wealthier people just like, I'm just going to pay it because this is the way I want to drive?
They didn't find significant differences on income, and
they did look at it.
They did look at it, and the sample was selected deliberately to provide a variety of incomes and household sizes and household locations throughout the Seattle area and occupations. Then they oversampled for people who use transit just to get a better understanding of how transit and pricing related to each other, and they did statistical corrections for that oversampling when they looked at their final results. So as I described a little bit before, the technology uses devices that can live inside the car and are pretty much self-contained. They communicate with the entire system through the cell phone network to learn what the current price is and to report back how much money you used on your trip. The back-end systems maintain the accounts. They don't know where the individual vehicles have traveled. And another advantage of having all the technology inside little boxes inside the vehicles is that you don't need a lot of on-road technology. You don't need gantries.
Transponder cost is fairly insignificant now, isn't it?
Yes, the simple transponders. But then you do need a fairly significant investment in the devices on the roadside to read those transponders if you use those.
How subject are they to tampering?
Either a transponder or one of these devices can be hidden, can be shielded from the sensors, or in the case of the onboard units, you can shield it from communicating with the GPS satellites to learn where it is. But in the case of the transponders, if the reader doesn't read the transponder, then it's the same as not having one. So they'll capture a picture of your license plate if that's the system they're using, and track you down that way. I would guess that you could have similar ways of finding out if someone is operating an onboard unit that isn't communicating with the satellite. It should be able to phone home and say so. If it isn't phoning home at all, then that would be another technological enforcement issue. So So one of the things we looked at in the paper that we produced for the prior highway cost allocation study was a research plan to get to efficient pricing in Oregon. The first step would be a pure research plan to determine the cost effectiveness of actually implementing it, characterize the options for technology, policy, and finance, and guide the technical and organizational plans. And then the next step would be to develop both a technical implementation plan, which is all the technical details of how it could happen, and an organizational implementation plan, which would be identifying all of the roles and responsibilities for each of the agencies, for communicating and educating the public, and setting up provisions for out-of-state travelers, for Oregonians without bank accounts, and so on. And it could also be integrated into the least cost planning for transportation. And as Mark pointed out, the research plan is a part of the upcoming highway cost allocation study. If the legislature is interested in achieving efficient pricing, the steps beyond that would be to fund the technical and organizational plans and then to make a decision to actually implement it.
You know, I guess a big question on that is to how frequently, say it a different way, what externalities do you choose to price and how frequently do you choose to incorporate that? The technical piece of the legislation price setting, I mean, we don't have a good track record of keeping up the cost. Our prices with cost, taxes with cost. And then there's, although we do have some good examples, the green light for trucks is a pretty good program. I mean, that worked pretty well, but it's pretty narrow. The other piece I wondered about, the Seattle study, I mean, it's sort of the, I forget what we call it, the effect of a study is when you voluntarily get people involved in a study, they pay a lot of attention. And the real question from an economics perspective is when you move that to the general population, other than the initial impact, what's the long-term impact? Do they really change patterns or does it revert? I guess if they revert or change, it doesn't make a difference. You still end up, if you've got it priced right, of getting the cost covered.
And I think a lot of people do pay attention to how much they pay for things. Not everyone would pay a lot of attention, but
you see that with people chasing 2 cents at the gas station.
That's true, Senator Byer. And I think, but that highlights the fact that getting the price is going to be important. Getting this price right and setting these properly, and it's a non-trivial exercise.
And then the implementation piece. I mean, the beauty of the current gas tax system is it's really easy to collect. The downside of it is we don't adjust it very much.
I'm wondering to what extent is increasing the efficiency of our transportation system, or through efficient pricing, to what extent does that overlap perfectly or imperfectly with just the speed in getting somewhere? I mean, I don't need to be charged more for going down River Road, to get to Beltline from my house. I mean, the lines, 3 cycles to get through a light tells me that I should go over Irving and to Northwest Expressway to get downtown, and I'll save myself 10 minutes. And I just know that. If I leave my house to take my daughter to school, 1 minute, even 30 seconds after 8:35, it's going to take me longer to go that way than going the other way. I mean, I know where that breakpoint is because I do it every day. And so, I don't need a higher price on River Road to tell me that. you know, we're not generating any money through my decision, but we are, you know, individuals are optimizing the system to a degree, and maybe not to as great a degree, just because we don't want to be sitting in traffic, you know, and time is limited. And so this is a really interesting idea to me, but a lot of stuff to absorb here, and kind of a lot of it I'm really uncomfortable with.
Well, there have been different,
but I'm also uncomfortable with the
different studies, you know, across the world. I think in Scandinavia was, I assume they still are pretty big on peak time pricing, and they would have trucks lined up on the side of the road waiting for 15 minutes for the pricing to change. I guess that's a pricing problem more than anything else.
it may make a big difference. One of the reasons that congestion pricing works is that congestion is a very nonlinear phenomenon. You can add a small number of vehicles to a facility that's at capacity, and it can make a very large difference in the time it takes to traverse that facility.
Right.
And likewise, taking a small number of convincing a small number of vehicles to either go a different way, go a different time, or use a different mode can make a big difference in the time it takes all the other people who don't make that. Who don't change their behavior.
Yeah.
I had the discussion of tolling yesterday on CRC hearing, and it's implied that people would divert, but you serve like when neither the bridges are functioning, I'm not sure how much diversion actually will take place, or, you know, what's a $2 toll going to get you if you spend an extra $4 in gas and traffic? Yeah. Plus time. Anything else? This was just an information. It wasn't an action item. I guess if there's to be action, at some point will there be a request for research, further research? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, Senator Beyer, our legislative revenue office is here. Do you have
Hazen's, yeah. He's there. He's been watching.
On the next steps, yeah. Where are we going to go? At some point, we're going to need to make some major legislation in terms of rates. Even if we were to stick to the same rate mile gas tax system, we'll have to make, you know, every 2-3 bienniums, we have to readjust, recalibrate these things in a major piece of legislation. My thinking is that if the legislature were to want to take on some of these bigger things, that would be a good timing for it. Would be the next thing.
Okay, so that I assume will probably, if it comes up, will come up in 15 session.
Yes, Chair Byer, Nazem Malik, Legislative Revenue Office, for the record. That is correct. If that comes, would be part of the 15th session agenda.
That's true. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. It's a fascinating subject.
Thank you.
Enjoy it. Anything else?
No, Mr. Chair, just need your signatures.
Long morning. We are adjourned. All right, long morning. We are adjourned.